It's Ethics Forward, your weekly deep dive into ethical issues in our daily lives and social institutions. My name's Avery Kohlers. I teach philosophy at the University of Louisville. And every week I sit down with a scholar, an activist, or a practitioner about ethical issues as they see them. This week, on Monday, December 10th, we marked the 70th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The UDHR is the founding document of what's sometimes called the International Bill of Human Rights, a bill that includes additional documents such as the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, as well as the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and so on. Some people argue that, for all the horrific violence of the 20th century, the international human rights movement is perhaps the greatest instance of moral progress in human history. But what are human rights? Where do they come from? How do we know what makes something a human right, or for that matter, a right at all? And how has the 70-year human rights movement contributed to the content of the human rights that it has enshrined? Well, to answer these questions, I called up Dr. Kristen Hessler, an expert on human rights in the philosophy department at the University at Albany in the State University of New York. Kristen has written articles on the human right to health, and particularly women's human rights. Ethics Forward will be back in just a moment with Dr. Kristen Hessler on the nature and meaning of human rights. Don't go away! It's Ethics Forward on WFMP 106.5 FM in lovely downtown Louisville, Kentucky, and my guest is Professor Kristen Hessler of the University of Albany. Kristen, welcome to Ethics Forward.
Hi, Avery. Thanks so much. I'm happy to be here.
Well, we've just passed International Human Rights Day, and so I thought that it would be an ideal time to talk about sort of the ethics, the foundations of human rights, and how they are connected to the rights that people are very familiar with. So, for instance, people think of their rights as delivered by the Bill of Rights in the Constitution or something like that. Would you say that the Bill of Rights, as we have it in the Constitution, is a list of human rights, or are rights declarations like that sort of all independent and separate?
That's a really great question. And obviously, philosophy of human rights, there are going to be people who give you different answers to that question. And I guess one way that's helpful to think about it is to think about what we think human rights are, and start there.
Right.
And so if you think that human rights are a certain subset of moral rights, and a lot of philosophers do, and they say one thing that's interesting about human rights as moral rights is that they're supposed to be the moral rights that all human beings have, maybe just in virtue of being human, for example. That's one answer.
Right.
So if you give that answer to that question, then you can say that the Constitution of the United States or of South Africa or of wherever might get it right, might be a good constitution precisely to the degree that it overlaps and gets right those moral rights that we all have, virtue of being human, and, you know, successfully codifies that into the respective constitution. And so that's one way to answer your question about constitutional rights and their relationship to human rights.
Right.
But that's not the only kind of answer you could give. So you might also think that human rights are not supposed to be just a subset of the moral rights that all people have just in virtue of being human. You might think, no, they're a special kind of moral rights that has a certain kind of pedigree. And so how do we know it's a human right? Well, we look to international politics in a particular way. One way would be just to look at the content of treaties, conventions, maybe the UN Declaration on Human Rights from 1948, and see what's there. That would be a very positivistic way to look at international politics, but there are other ways to do that as well. You could imagine, what are those rights that, if a government didn't protect them for their citizens, that government would in some way lose some aspect of its legitimacy. And then you go through that intellectual exercise and you come up with that list of human rights. And those, if you go that branch, you know, that kind of answer, you might not necessarily see constitutional rights and international human rights overlap, and you might not necessarily think that they should in order for constitutions to be good constitutions.
Right.
So that's a little bit of the landscape of the possible answers to that question.
Right. Okay. So the one account is positivist, which is about where they come from, and they come from a set of declarations and conventions. And the other is really sort of foundationally moral, that
as you said, it's a criterion of the legitimacy of any government that it meets those human rights. Is that fair?
Yeah, and those are two different ways of going the international politics route. Yeah.
Okay.
And then there's a sort of human rights have to be moral rights, and we can generate a list of those, right, where that story is human rights are the moral rights that all humans have in virtue of being human. Yeah.
Right. So we might look at something like the Bill of Rights, just to go back to that as a starting point, and say, well, some of these map on reasonably well, and others don't. And so some of them are ascriptions to us of human rights, and some of them are just sort of conventional political rights. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. And so maybe I'd like to sort of ask questions about both of the directions that you mentioned for international legal justifications. Let me start with the positivistic account, which is that they're enshrined in codes and documents. So I guess that bumps up the question a bit higher. This is sort of the same question over again. Is something like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, or take one that's in dispute in the United States, the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, is that a list of human rights? Can we not ask just the same thing, right? Can we say, oh, look, the UDHR got something wrong? Or is it just right just because it's, by definition, what it is for something to be a human right?
Yeah, if you go the positive route, you lose the ability to connect with what a lot of people think we're talking about when we're talking about human rights, which is the moral urgency that we understand ourselves to be trying to identify when we're talking about human rights issues. And so if we don't make a big deal out of other branches of international law, like the law of the sea or territorial waters or something like that on a moral basis, or certain aspects of trade law or such things. Right, there are moral issues connected to those, but we don't necessarily think that because we're talking about something as part of international law that it necessarily has the kind of moral urgency that we normally associate with human rights. And so going the positivistic route in a strict way for human rights runs the risk of disconnecting human rights from what we take to be their moral importance. That doesn't have to be the last word on that.
Mm-hmm.
You might think that the process that generates those lists itself is something that we ought to respect in such a way that we recognize those lists as having moral significance just because of the international political process that generated them.
I see, right.
And so that's another possible way to sort of try to reconnect them, even if you're looking at, this is in the Convention on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, therefore it has a moral importance. But your story would be different. It's not that they've correctly identified some abstract, predetermined subset of moral rights that we ought to all care about. It's that actually there's a distinctively political moral authority to that procedure. So
right.
You could argue that, and that's, I think, a really interesting kind of question about whether that argument can work. But a lot of people think that if you take just the Declaration, for example, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the kind of international dialogue that did occur to generate that list without foundations, deliberately without specifying why these rights are important, but saying that they are,
mm-hmm.
A number of people who are attracted to the idea that that does generate a kind of normative significance for that list in particular, because it represents a kind of point of agreement about things that we do think are important for the dignity of human lives. And so, that's one way to try to reconnect them, even if we're taking a quasi-positivistic route.
Right. Great. So let me press on that for a minute, though. I really like that approach. So just to see if I can make sure I am grasping it correctly. So the idea is that it's not the substance of the agreement that matters, it's how it was reached. So much as it's just a matter of procedural justice, so much as it doesn't matter who gets which half of a cookie, right, it matters that we fairly divided it. Or the better example is it doesn't matter. So whoever wins the pot in poker, there's no justice necessarily in who wins. The justice is in that it was a fair play, right?
Something like that, yeah.
So, but
that would be more like a strictly procedural justice or a pure procedural justice.
Yeah.
You might not want to bank everything. I mean, I don't know of an argument that suggests that international procedures, whatever the outcome is, should be considered fully just or fully determinate.
Right.
It, in that direction could be considered as kind of conferring normative authority on the outcome if the procedures are inclusive and genuinely multicultural and respect everyone's perspective and things like that.
Yeah, good. So a certain kind of constrained proceduralism.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, and so I guess then that forces the factual question. In your view, I mean, I don't know if you're stating that some people have that view. You're not necessarily buying that view. But in your view, would it be fair to say that the procedures that generated, say, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights met these criteria, or it was a very small collection of states pre-decolonization? African Americans couldn't vote, so were barely allowed to vote. So who represented the United States is hardly morally permissible. So I guess I wonder if you think that as a matter of fact, even despite those limitations, the procedures were good enough to confer at least constrained legitimacy on their outcomes.
That's a great question. I agree with all your reservations about the Universal Declaration in particular. And so I think it's helpful to broaden the frame and look at certainly not just the Universal Declaration, but International Bill of Rights. You were talking about the Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, but also the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and how they're supposed to be the legal codification of the basic ideas that were more unified in the Universal Declaration.
Right.
But also the number of other treaties that have followed since. So the Women's Treaty, Treaty Against Racial Discrimination, etc.
Right.
And you start to see much more grassroots input, much more truly international dialogue, and you start to see some of the same ideas coming up over and over again.
Right.
And so I think that the procedures matter more for what we could call the whole international human rights movement or system or regime or whatever word you want to use, especially since there's deliberation built into the functioning of that system. And I think that matters as well for all the reservations that you had about the Universal Declaration.
Right.
So if State A ratifies a treaty with a certain number of reservations, State B can say, actually, I think those reservations are incompatible with the point and purpose of the treaty.
Uh-huh.
And then you get a kind of ongoing international deliberation process going that's by design part of the regime itself. And so I think that the kinds of arguments that are strongest that come from this procedural direction have that broad scope in mind.
Right. Okay, fantastic. And so we've been talking about the sort of the positivistic, a more or less positivistic version of the account of where human rights come from. And I guess that the contrast that, and I want to get to it in just a moment, the contrast is with a sort of a more natural law or moralistic conception of where human rights come from. But I guess I have a question about what some people might call the moral productivity of the positivistic conception. Do you think that positive human rights can then come to have moral force, or do you think that the moral world is independent of the political world, is more wholly independent and abstract of the political world? I know it's a very abstract question, but I guess the idea would be, like, so take, for instance, the right to marry and found a family, which is in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So the right to have representation on the job, like a ability to form a union. Is it plausible to say that these become moral rights because they were agreed to in the right sort of way in a political structure? Or is the moral world more independent of what our political structures yield?
I'm going to show my hand and say I'm much more sympathetic to a version of a kind of political argument about human rights.
I'm sorry, say it again. The what version?
A political argument about human rights rather than the moral.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Fundamentalist argument.
Yeah.
Partly because I do think that human beings interacting in constrained ways can generate norms that have moral authority for us.
Right.
And that's a perspective on human rights that I find most congenial to think about.
Right.
But when I think about my own work, I don't just think about the generation of lists of human rights through the official procedures of the international legal regime. I also want to look at human rights, what we call practice, so
right.
Human rights activism, and how those voices, voices of activists, victims' movements, etc., have engaged with the regime itself to try to articulate norms that I think we all recognize as important. And often these worlds meet. You've got activists working on something that they care about, for example, in post-conflict situations, right, where you have a legal procedure in place to try to adjudicate what happened in conflict situations. And again, there's procedures that I think can bring to our attention voices that we might not otherwise hear. Or one thing that I find important in my own work is recognizing that as a source of moral knowledge. So we don't get all of our moral knowledge about human rights just abstractly thinking about a more purified moral realm and then expect our experience of talking to victims or those who are on trial for human rights abuses or something like that to conform to what we theoretically have designed in our heads as the true concept of human rights.
Right.
So I'm drawing a very stark contrast there just to make the point. But that's to say, when we include the practice in how we understand human rights politics, I think that, yes, those processes really do give us very many reasons to care morally about what is proclaimed as human rights and what people say in their own voices, right? This is happening and it's a human rights violation.
Right.
That doesn't mean that that's, we don't need to think critically about it, but
right,
I do think that's a source of normativity, yeah.
Right. That's fascinating. So can you maybe give an example of what's a new human right, or what are some new human rights that have emerged in this way, and maybe just say whether what we now have is knowledge that they've been human rights all along, as it were,
yeah,
or whether what we have is now a new human right?
I'm going to answer that question based on a paper I've been working on that's going to be really part of my book. But it's not really about a new human right exactly, but I think it is relevant to how we think about rights that we already accept. And so I'm thinking here about what does gender equality mean? And we might think that as a human right, gender equality requires the absence of formal discrimination, the recognition, legally speaking, of equal rights on paper and in practice, like everybody should have the right to vote, regardless of being male, female, or their gender identification. And so we might have a kind of formalistic absence of discrimination as our standard for gender equality. But I think that a lot of feminists and a lot of activists on behalf of women think that actually achieving equality for women requires a lot more than that. And one way that this has come out, I think, can be illustrated via a case I've been thinking about that was before the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. And I should maybe say I'm going to be talking about sexual violence here, just as a heads up for where the conversation is going.
Thanks.
So, of course, as part of the genocide in Rwanda, there was a lot of sexual violence. And the case before the ICTR, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, that tried Jean-Paul Akiyesu, who was the mayor of Taba, he was charged with a number of counts of inciting genocide in speeches that he gave. And in the course of the trial, so no charges were originally brought regarding sexual violence at all. Except for that, in the discussion when witnesses were speaking during the trial, they started speaking about sexual violence that took place under his command at government buildings in Taba, where he was mayor.
Right.
And the charges, therefore, were ultimately revised in response to various amicus briefs that were filed. And no one accused him of perpetrating any sexual violence. So he was charged as a commander for failing to prevent it.
Huh.
And at least tacitly giving permission for it to happen, it seemed like. And he was found guilty. And so this was the first time that a superior had been held responsible for sexual violence that occurred under his command. And it was the first successful prosecution for sexual violence as a means of genocide. So it was a number of firsts in international law.
Wow.
And so what I've been thinking about is how several legal commentators on this case have argued that the definition of rape that the ICTR used is different than the one used in a lot of domestic jurisdictions. And we recognize that prosecuting rape is very difficult, even in the absence of genocide and armed conflict, like happened in Rwanda. And so some feminist theorists have been looking at this and thinking about how do we make women's rights more protected by making sexual violence more successfully prosecutable, even in domestic situations? And is this development in international law that was pretty explicitly designed to respond to this horrific, exceptional case, but how can we use it to make women's equality, so women's equal enjoyment of the objects of their human rights, including rights to bodily security, more real, more right. substantively realized in everyday life? And so this is not a new human right, but I think it makes us think about women's human rights to everyday things like bodily security in a different way, and that we might not have thought about were there not these procedures in international law to hear these voices and to put these two issues together as a way of thinking about, okay, maybe actually equally protecting women's basic human rights requires a lot more than the kind of formal equality that I was describing before. Right. It might need a lot of activism to change the way our legal systems tend to work on an everyday basis. And that, I think, again, is a kind of procedure that we ought to recognize as sources of moral knowledge that we might not otherwise have access to.
Right.
I changed your question slightly, but...
To the better.
Okay.
So that's fascinating. So if I can go back to the very beginning and put this back into the comparison or contrast with something like the U.S. Constitution Bill of Rights, would you say that the kind of legal tradition that we have around the interpretation of the Constitution in the court system and maybe to some degree in legislation has been parallel? I mean, I guess what I want to know is, let's take something like, and obviously there's going to be some overlap, but something like the Fourth Amendment, or maybe the Eighth Amendment is a good example. So the Fourth Amendment guarantees our personal effects against unreasonable search and seizure, and Eighth Amendment protects us against cruel and unusual punishments. Would you say that the kind of bottom-up activism around constitutional rights has been as vigorous and as much of a source of moral knowledge as activism around, say, the right to be free from sexual violence in the international human rights context? Or I guess what I'm asking is, are human rights unique in having generated this tradition of activism that generates moral knowledge, or are we seeing the same thing domestically?
That's a great question. I'm most familiar with arguments about the Eighth Amendment, for example, in terms of the death penalty,
right?
Solitary confinement, things like that. And I think that there are a lot of voices trying to speak to that, and it can be difficult for those voices to be heard in a constitutional sense. But that's the point of having appeals go all the way up to the Supreme Court, is that, and then we could talk about how that process, how accessible is that process, and whether the wind needs to already have shifted politically before those voices get heard all the way up to the Supreme Court, so that we start shifting our understanding of whether the death penalty really is cruel and unusual punishment. But, so again, I'm going to slightly shift your question to try to bring the two together, constitutional and international law. And we could talk about the Eighth Amendment in particular and the death penalty to say one wind seems to be shifting, which is that the Supreme Court has changed a lot. Uh-huh. But for a while it started seeming like justices were maybe a little bit more open to thinking about how practices, say, regarding the death penalty in the United States, and if they were out of step with international practice, not just international human rights law, but constitutional law in other countries, that maybe that itself is a reason, right? A kind of consensus that we need to take into consideration when we're considering what is cruel and unusual punishment. So one question about interpretation is, do we have a uniquely American conception of what is cruel and unusual punishment, or does the practice of humanity more broadly matter to what counts morally as cruel and unusual punishment?
Right.
And there have been a number of arguments, right, to say that the United States is quite out of step regarding the death penalty and incarceration practices more broadly, of course. And then there's a legitimate argument about to what extent that matters in our legal tradition. And it had started seeming regarding the death penalty that the international community's standards about cruel and unusual punishment might be authoritative within our system of constitutional interpretation. I'm not sure where we're going with that right now. I was thinking about that issue more a few years ago. Uh-huh. Things are maybe quite different now. But that's one way that I think the form of moral reasoning that I'm talking about can, when we broaden our perspective globally and internationally, that it really does seem to mean that, and obviously I'm going to be on the favor of the side that says the practices of humanity broadly should be considered, if we're out of step with them in the direction of imposing the death penalty more often, that we should be taking this as evidence that we're out of step with probably morally best practices, and we really need to think about that. And if we're going to remain out of step, we need a really good argument for why.
Right.
And so, yeah, that's broadly gesturing back towards not constitutional law again, but to the kinds of processes that generate moral knowledge that I think is important out of international human rights law, even when we're thinking about the domestic context.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
I'll be back with Kristen Hessler in just a moment.
I'm talking to Kristen Hessler, professor of philosophy at the University at Albany in New York. She's a philosopher of human rights, a political philosopher more generally, focused on international law and human rights. And we're talking about human rights because it's International Human Rights Day, or it was just this week. And so it's an ideal time to talk about that. And so, Kristen, we've been talking about this one way of understanding human rights, which is sort of positivistic, that they get generated through practices, treaties, conventions, activism at the global level and in the wake of conflict, victims movements and so on, criminal tribunals. But at the beginning, you distinguish that from another direction, which is sort of more naturalistic or with morality as the foundation, where human rights have special status. They're particularly important rights that then serve as criteria for the evaluation of the legitimacy of any state. So I guess you've sort of already laid your cards on the table that that's not the direction you go. So I guess what I want to ask is, if one wanted to go that way and develop a theory of human rights that was morally foundational, where would you find human rights? How would you know you'd identified them correctly? And I guess it's, what's the moral theory that generates them? And maybe sort of a subsidiary question, what is a right, and how do you know that a right that you've discovered is a human right rather than, say, some other kind of right?
Yeah, that's the challenge, that last question you just specified. So I think there's a lot of agreement that a right is supposed to be a kind of claim that you can make against another human being or entity or even your state, for example, and where you have some kind of warrant for that claim, that someone needs to be doing something for you to refrain from treating you in a certain way or something like that.
Right.
And then how you ground those rights, and this is about rights broadly, differs from theorist to theorist. So broadly speaking, one way of going is to say that there's something, some moral goal or value that we're protecting. For example, maybe it's your well-being or your interests when we're responding to those claims. Another way of going is more sort of autonomy-based, right? That a right is something that you're exercising your will in a certain way and exerting a kind of power in the world by making those kinds of claims. And so we're in a way protecting your autonomy or something. Those kinds of theories of rights in general, there's a lot of literature about which kind of theory of right ends up being better and for what reasons. But I'll just leave that aside for now and just say, when we get to human rights, though, your question about how do we know that we've identified human rights as opposed to moral rights broadly, is a really good question. And so there's one way in the human rights literature of sort of specifying human rights, and I think I used this locution before, are the rights that all persons have just in virtue of their humanity, right, or just because they are human. And it gets very difficult to come up with a list of things that literally all human beings have, a right that all human beings have. And one question that exercises philosophers working in this area is, how timeless are these rights supposed to be? Mm-hmm. So if they really belong to all human beings, no matter what, then, you know, 10,000 years ago, human beings should have had the same rights. And that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense, because so many rights that we think of as human rights depend on modern political systems, right, economic systems, probably almost a lot of the rights that we've talked about, except maybe basic bodily security, in some way refer to these kinds of modern contexts.
Right.
And so did they always have them, or right? And they just weren't quite relevant until those institutions came about, and that seems odd. And so you get various conceptual problems, and I'm not saying political ones. Political here don't have conceptual problems, but these are the kinds of things that are kind of carving moral foundationalist theorists into different camps.
Is there an account of sort of something basic that implies everything else that applies only in the modern world? Like, I don't know, can people say dignity? And of course, what is required for dignity changes with your society, but it's the right to dignity is what all humans have always and everywhere. Is that plausible? Or autonomy, or whatever is the... Yeah. Is that how it works, then?
Yeah, and your interests change, right? So if you have an interest theory, you can say our interests are different now that we live under these institutions than they were beforehand. Yeah. Another kind of theory, and this is what I was going to say before, is that human rights protect your agency. That's James Griffin's idea.
Right.
And so what you need in order to protect your agency is going to in part be dependent on what Henry should call standard threats to your agency.
Right.
And standard threats are going to change as our political and economic world changes. So as states become more powerful, they can become not only protectors, but also violators, obviously, of human rights. And so the content of human rights will change as our institutions change, because what constitutes threats to our basic interests or to our autonomy, our rational agency, whatever the theorist thinks human rights are supposed to protect, those will change as circumstances change. That's the standard kind of response to that worry.
Yeah. And just to clarify, by agency, you mean like our capacity to understand what's good for us and to act on it? Is that fair? Or how would you define agency?
Yeah. To understand and develop a conception of a good life, and then to be able to pursue it in some kind of meaningful way, not just imagine it, but pursue it actively.
Okay. Great. And so either account of human rights, really, either the positivistic one or the moral foundationalist one, is supposed to give us criteria to assess the legitimacy of states and political regimes, right? Isn't it?
It's a good question. So some might want to say that that's a kind of arbitrary restriction on the idea of human rights. So they might want to say, you could violate my human rights, just as private individuals.
Right.
And so Thomas Poga has this view that in order for something to count as a human rights violation, there has to be what he calls official misconduct, or you have to implicate official conduct in some way, either by directly doing the violating or by failing to redress violations of a systematic nature, for example. And so I think one line he has is something like, you know, so a state confiscating my car because I'm a political opponent might count as a human rights violation, even if I have other cars.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not really about how badly off I'm made, but an abusive husband, I think, is something he says, right, is not a human rights violator.
I see.
Vis-a-vis the abuse, because there's no official conduct. And so then what he's trying to do is shift the frame of reference to from an interpersonal interactionist sense to what he calls the institutional sense.
Right.
So we assess the human rights situation within a state by asking, does everyone have reliable access to the objects of their human rights? And it's a state's obligation to ensure that.
Right.
And you could have that be the case. You could have everybody enjoy very secure access to the objects of human rights, even if you have incidental crime here and there. But though they wouldn't, on his view, count as human rights abuses. And that's a different perspective than the perspective that says, sure, right, anytime someone murders someone else, that's a human rights violation in the interpersonal sense.
Right, right. Yeah. So the question, if the question is, what are human rights for? And one account is, and I guess this is the POGA account, if I'm repeating it back to you correctly, it's that they're for the assessment of the basic moral permissibility of institutional regimes, whereas somebody else might think they are for the protection of people from any threat at all, really.
To whatever, exactly. I think that's a good way of putting it, yeah.
Okay, okay. But even on the latter conception, it's not as though the institutional account is wrong, it's just that it's too narrow, right? So they both include that?
Yes, there are a lot of views that say, sure, we should include institutional culpability, but why shouldn't we also think that a random murder is a human rights violation?
Right, got it. Okay, so I guess where I want to go then is to ask, do you think that from a human rights perspective, we live in a legitimate state or in a legitimate institutional order?
No. But there are degrees of illegitimacy as well.
Okay.
And I don't know how much you want to go into the idea of legitimacy, and maybe I answered too quickly, but because I think the concept of legitimacy itself is supposed to give you some room to, like, to malfunction, right? Uh-huh. Where the system can malfunction.
Right.
And yet still retain some normative authority. And so you might understand illegitimate to be, right, completely lacking in legitimacy, and I don't mean that either. But do we live in a regime of the kind that POGA describes, where everybody enjoys reliable access to the object of their human rights? Definitely not.
Right.
And there's a lot that we could point to that would suggest otherwise, and some we've already mentioned. Incarceration practices in the United States, I think felon disenfranchisement is by itself a condition in which some people are actively rendered voiceless, which renders the political system itself less legitimate,
right,
even while it's arguably violating the human rights of the individuals it's disenfranchising.
Right.
So that's a kind of cyclical process of delegitimization as
right.
It functions.
Yeah, a downward spiral.
Exactly. Negative feedback loop, whatever you want to call it.
Right, right. So actually that's a good reminder, though, the rights that we might have on either account of human rights, the rights we might have, or I should say any, because we've now got a whole sort of archipelago of them, not just two, but on any account of human rights, it seems as though that the rights that people might have are not just to attainments of things like basic needs and so on, but also are participatory rights, rights to participate in self-government and so on.
Yeah, I think those are extremely important ones, and I'm worried about the direction that we're going in terms of making it more difficult for people to exercise their political voice. And that's not, you know, felony disenfranchisement, but just practical hurdles that make it much more difficult for people to exercise their human rights, I think, are practical obstacles to saying that we're fully legitimate human rights regime here.
Right, right. Okay, that's fascinating and worrisome. So we're running a bit low on time. I was wondering if you could say, though, given that your approach to human rights is this sort of institutionally productive one and grounded in practices, what's your view of human rights organizations that we see from our perspective, either on the international stage, like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, or domestically? Are there organizations that you would consider human rights organizations domestically? And how are they doing? Are they contributing in the way that they should or could? We might sometimes worry that these very large, financially wealthy Washington, D.C. organizations are likely not doing much good at all. I wonder if you have a sense of that. Who should we be supporting, if we should be supporting anybody at all?
Not sure I should be trusted to be directive in that way.
Sorry.
But let me just say that it seems like part of what you're asking is about the contrast between a large, easily recognizable international NGO like the two you mentioned versus, like, who counts as a human rights group. And I think there are lots of activist groups that we might not think of as human rights groups.
Mm-hmm.
But that if you think about the change they're trying to bring about, and you think about the goals of the International Human Rights movement, you'll realize there's a plethora of human rights groups that aren't necessarily calling themselves that.
Right.
And partly it's political. It's a political decision. And human rights are, like, our culture in the United States is not hooked in very much to the authority of the international human rights regime. And so there's a limited payoff for right. domestic activist groups to say we're doing human rights work here. But if you think about the groups behind the ballot initiatives in the last election to reinstate voting rights
I
to
see, right.
those convicted of felonies who have served their time already, in my view, that's a human rights issue.
Right.
And I would count those as human rights groups for sure.
Okay.
And relevant to my ongoing research, there's a lot of groups who are working to improve around the world women's access to healthcare, including things like giving women final say over their own healthcare decisions.
Right.
And they may or may not count their work as human rights work, but again, in my view, that would be. So, yeah, those large NGOs deliberately and by design have their own focus.
Yeah.
But I think it was Human Rights Watch, who was one of the organizations that submitted an amicus brief in the case I was talking about earlier, the Akieso case before the ICTR. And that was a pretty, you know, they had to be pretty nimble on their feet to respond in the middle of the trial and submit an amicus brief. And, you know, so hats off to them for that, too.
Right. Great. And I'm really glad that you mentioned your work, because that's where I wanted to go next in the time we have remaining. You are currently working on a book on women's human right to health, and I wonder if you can say something about that. I mean, obviously, we hear in the United States people advocating for universal health care say health care is a human right. Can you talk about what needs to be proven in that ground in order to defend that claim that health care is a human right? Am I making sense?
Yeah. So how do we establish that health care is a human right?
Yeah.
So that's a great question, and I'm really not answering that question as at a foundational level.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working with the importance of healthcare to women's equality in a variety of respects.
I see.
And we could talk about that globally, but one thing I want to focus on is the connection between human rights, equality, and health.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking about the United States in particular, and problematizing equal access to healthcare by women. And so how, again, referring to the change to Supreme Court and the prospects that that raises for Roe v. Wade, but even in the absence of overturning Roe v. Wade, the fact that it's becoming much more difficult for women to access reproductive healthcare in wide swaths of the country is, again, making it difficult for women to exercise, I think, human rights that they're entitled to. But the idea of equality also helps me look at how different women fare in terms of, say, maternal mortality within the United States, which looks right. very different if you're talking about different racially identified groups. And it seems to me that from a population or institutional perspective, that indicates that different groups of women do not enjoy equal access to the objects of their human rights. And that suggests a kind of structural problem as well.
Right.
And so partly my approach draws more on public health ethics than mm-hmm. it does on traditional medical bioethics.
Great.
And that, I think, is because that's more compatible with something like an institutional or political view of human rights.
Right. So that's really interesting. I'm glad that you mentioned that, in part because the maternal mortality issue shows that when it comes to women's human right to health care, it's not just access to abortion, although that's the main focus of Roe v. Wade, obviously. But then with differential maternal mortality in the U.S., it's really not, is it fair to say, it's not principally about access to health care. It's about everything that happens before you end up in a hospital bed. Is that?
Absolutely. And the background, right, social determinants of health become relevant in a very deep way. And so, one challenge for my view ends up carving away human rights from social justice more broadly,
right.
As opposed to carving away human rights from a larger set of moral rights, like we were talking about earlier. From my perspective, I think it's a challenge that I'm still working on to specify what, if anything, is the difference between the kind of human rights I'm talking about and what we might consider a broader perspective of social justice. But to me, that's the landscape that we've laid out where my view is, I mean, closer to theories of social justice.
Right. And maybe this is what you're pushing up against, that there's this worry that the idea of a right to health or the good of health sort of colonizes all of social justice, because once you talk about the social determinants of health, you're talking about income, dress on the job, and so is that where you're going? Like, you have to find a line between what claims we have to health and what claims are somehow grounded differently?
Yes, exactly. So especially since I'm thinking of human rights to equality in a variety of respects, equality itself is a very demanding norm of social justice.
Right.
And especially if we're not thinking of it in that formal way that I was describing at the start of our interview, but rather really as equal standing and equal access to objects of our human rights, right? Those are much more demanding conceptions of equality.
Right.
And so if we have a typical kind of, so to refer to Amnesty International, for example, traditional understanding of human rights as a floor, human rights construct a floor, and we're never, never, never supposed to sink below that floor. Any violation of human rights is automatically a tragedy and a huge miscarriage of morality.
Right.
But rather, as when my conception of human rights gets more demanding than that, you lose that connection to traditional understandings of human rights.
Right.
And that's, you might say, well, those things seem morally important, but not as urgent as something like torture.
Right.
And so why should we consider all those things human rights?
Yeah, great. We're almost out of time. So last substantive question. Some people, when they say things like water is a human right or healthcare is a human right, they imply that it would be wrong for those things to be commodified.
Yes.
And do you think that markets have a role in the provision of human rights? Or do you think that things that are the objects of our human rights should be somehow protected from the market, for better or for worse?
That's a great question. Personally, my view is not that if something is a human right, markets can't be involved. But if markets are involved, then we, and this is going to be part of where I go to explain why these are still human rights, even though they get expansive, you have to be very careful not to price people out of the market for something like water.
Right.
Or healthcare, right? Where these are literally life and death issues.
Yeah.
And if you're going to involve markets, there has to be support for people to be able to participate in a meaningful way in those markets.
Right.
And we might think that markets and other things, couches, cars, whatever, right, don't have that moral urgency to say, well, we can have markets involved, but if people can't participate in those markets, it's whatever, they're just missing out, but it's not a huge injustice. But not so for when what is commodified is an object of people's human rights.
Great. Thank you so much. And you mentioned your book. Can you say when people can expect to see it?
It's in the early stage. I'm still working on the manuscript. It's due late next year. And, of course, it's got all the review processes after that. So hopefully within 2 years.
Fantastic. Good luck with it. Kristen Hetzler, University at Albany, thank you so much. This has been just wonderful. I've learned so much. So I really appreciate your time and your wisdom.
Thanks, Avery. It was good to talk to you.
Likewise. Thanks. Dead.
that was my interview with the philosopher Kristen Hessler, who teaches at the University at Albany. Keep an eye out next year for her upcoming book on women's human right to health. If you want to find out more about the ways that the UN is marking the 70th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, you can surf over to standupforhumanrights.org using the number 4, standupforhumanrights.org. Ethics Forward comes to you from 106.5 FM Forward Radio in lovely downtown Louisville, Kentucky. Forward Radio is people-powered community radio, and it thrives on the volunteer labor of ordinary people like you and me. If you are looking for some outlets for your end-of-year philanthropic giving, consider this valuable community resource. Just surf on over to forwardradio.org and click on Donate. Ethics Forward comes to you every week on Tuesdays at 6 p.m. and is repeated Wednesdays at 10 a.m. and Thursdays at 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you're away from your radio or outside Jefferson County, you can tune in on forwardradio.org or wait till the show goes up on the Ethics Forward archive on SoundCloud. You can get there from forwardradio.org/ethicsforward. Ethics Forward always benefits from the music and production help of Prismic, who's also on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/prismicofficial. I'm also grateful to Maddie Klebo for her editorial and production work, and to the University of Louisville Philosophy Department, which makes her work possible. We'll be back next week with another deep dive into ethical issues in our daily lives and social institutions. Don't miss it. Thanks for listening. I'm